Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. This week, we feature new research on acute respiratory failure, wheezing in childhood, lung cancer, and obesity. We review myeloproliferative neoplasms and follow a diagnostic case of a patient with myasthenia gravis who developed dyspnea and weakness. Perspectives explore medical marijuana research, AI in clinical care, sexual and gender minority health research, and the Perspectives editor saying goodbye. Carbocysteine or hypertonic saline for acute respiratory failure by Bronwyn Connolly from the Queen's University Belfast, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Acute respiratory failure is the most common cause of patient admission to an intensive care unit, ICU. International data show that mucoactive agents have been used in more than 80% of ICUs and in approximately 20 to 30% of patients receiving invasive mechanical ventilation, with carbocysteine, a mucoregulator, and hypertonic saline, an expectorant, being the most commonly used mucoactive agents. However, a systematic review from 2020 concluded that the available evidence for use of mucoactive agents in patients with acute respiratory failure was limited. This randomized trial involved 1,956 critically ill, mechanically ventilated participants, 16 years of age or older, with acute respiratory failure and difficult-to-clear secretions. All participants received usual care, along with carbocysteine, 6% or 7% nebulized hypertonic saline, both interventions, or usual care alone, for up to 28 days. The addition of carbocysteine or hypertonic saline to usual care in critically ill patients with acute respiratory failure showed no benefit. Both mucoactive agents were associated with harm, and therefore their use in clinical practice warrants caution and reassessment. Carolyn LaVita and C. Corey Hardin from Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston, write in an editorial that these reported findings from a randomized controlled trial that tested therapies commonly used in the ICU on the basis of historical practice and lower quality evidence are a welcome addition to the literature. As such, the trial by Connolly and co-authors is a major contribution and ought to lead to a change in practice. Even with the acknowledgement of the limitations in an open-label pragmatic trial, the finding of a notable signal of harm, together with a lack of benefit with either therapy, a finding consistent with the limited literature, means that it is time to move away from the routine use of mucoactive agents in patients with acute respiratory failure. This report by Connolly et al. Once again affirms the value of performing randomized control trials to test established critical care practices that lack sufficient evidence of benefit. Azithromycin for preschoolers with wheezing in the emergency department by Kurt Denninghoff from the University of Arizona, Tucson, and co-authors. Wheezing illnesses are a leading cause of hospitalization for preschool-age children and are frequently treated with antibiotics. Observational studies have shown more frequent isolation of three pathogenic bacteria, Streptococcus pneumoniae, Moraxella catarrhalis, and Haemophilus influenzae, from nasopharyngeal samples from children with recurrent episodes of wheezing than from those without such illnesses. In this multicenter trial, 840 children 18 to 59 months of age who presented to an emergency department with a moderate to severe episode of wheezing were randomly assigned to receive azithromycin once daily or matching placebo for 5 days. 521 of the patients tested positive for pathogenic bacteria. The trial was stopped for futility by the Data and Safety Monitoring Board after a planned interim analysis. The primary outcome of the sum of scores on the asthma flare-up diary for young children over 5 days did not differ significantly between the azithromycin and placebo groups in either the cohort positive for pathogenic bacteria or the negative cohort. An important finding of the trial was that approximately 50% of the children in the trial were admitted to the hospital for treatment. Acute wheezing illnesses remain a substantial cause of respiratory distress and a driver of healthcare costs. In an editorial, Andrew Bush and Sajal Saglani from the Imperial College London write that the trial by Denninghoff and co-authors definitively shows that azithromycin is not beneficial for all children with acute wheezing attacks, nor is it beneficial for the subgroup of patients with positive nasopharyngeal cultures. But why not? One possibility is that some patients with positive cultures also had eosinophilic airway inflammation, and that treatment with systemic glucocorticoids masked any possible benefit of azithromycin. Another possibility is that these bacteria are not pathogenic, and culture positivity is a secondary phenomenon. Whatever the explanation, the management of acute wheezing in preschoolers remains non-evidence-based. The time has come to stop assuming that all wheezing attacks are the same. Instead, acute wheezing attacks can be phenotyped with point-of-care assessments of blood eosinophil counts and atopic status from the clinical history or previous testing for allergic sensitization. Such phenotyping would be useful for testing whether patients with atopic eosinophilia have a response to oral glucocorticoids, whereas those without eosinophilia can be given albuterol alone. Denninghoff et al. Have done us a signal service by highlighting that azithromycin is not a useful treatment in preschool-aged children with acute wheezing in the emergency department. Clinicians must resist the urge to prescribe treatments that not only are ineffective, but may also cause harm. First-line sunvozertinib in NSCLC with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. By Saiswin Jo, from the Hamburg Center for Kidney Health, Germany, and co-authors. Sunvozertinib received accelerated approval for use in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer, NSCLC, with epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, who have disease progression after chemotherapy. Data are needed on the efficacy and safety of sunvozertinib as a first-line treatment for NSCLC. In this Phase 3 trial, 324 patients with advanced non-squamous NSCLC with EGFR exon 20 insertions were randomly assigned to receive sunvozertinib or chemotherapy. Treatment with sunvozertinib led to significantly longer median progression-free survival than chemotherapy. In the sunvozertinib group, the most common adverse events of grade 3 or higher included increased serum creatine kinase levels, diarrhea, and anemia. Survodutide once weekly for the treatment of adults with obesity by Karel Leroux from the University College Dublin School of Medicine, Ireland, and co-authors. Although medications with glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, receptor agonist activity have transformed the management of obesity and shown substantial cardiometabolic benefits, unmet needs such as addressing metabolic dysfunction beyond weight loss remain. Survodutide, an investigational glucagon receptor, GLP-1 receptor, dual agonist, led to substantial weight reduction in a Phase 2 trial involving adults with obesity without diabetes. In this Phase 3 trial, 725 adults with a BMI of 30 or higher, or 27 or higher, with at least one obesity-related complication, excluding diabetes, were randomly assigned to receive once-weekly survodutide administered subcutaneously at a dose adjusted up to 3.6 milligrams or 6 milligrams, or placebo, in addition to counseling for lifestyle modification. For the treatment regimen estimand, the mean change in body weight at week 76 was -12.2% in the 3.6 milligram group, -13% in the 6 milligram group, and -5.4% in the placebo group. Survodutide led to significantly greater reductions in body weight than placebo in these adults. Gastrointestinal adverse events, primarily nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and constipation, occurred more often with survodutide than with placebo during the treatment period. Myeloproliferative neoplasms. A review article by Isabelle Plot and Villian Vanchancar from the Université Paris-Saclay, Gustave Roussy, Villejuif, France. Classic myeloproliferative neoplasms, including essential thrombocytopenia, polycythemia vera, and primary myelofibrosis, are chronic clonal hematopoietic stem cell disorders. These disorders are driven by gain-of-function mutations in the genes Janus kinase 2, JAK2, calreticulin, CalR, or the thrombopoietin receptor, MPL, that activate cytokine signaling. These mutations arise decades before clinical disease develops and confer a clonal advantage that is further shaped by commutations in epigenetic, splicing, or signaling genes. Inflammation enhances clonal dominance, favoring the development of myelofibrosis and thrombotic complications. Disease evolution may culminate in secondary acute myeloid leukemia, which has a poor prognosis. Current therapies primarily aim to control symptoms, thrombosis, and splenomegaly, but they have limited disease-modifying effects, except for pegylated interferon alpha and JAK2 inhibitors in some patients. Emerging therapies that selectively target mutant CalR and JAK2 V617F using immunotherapy and selective inhibitors could be a breakthrough in the treatment of persons with myeloproliferative neoplasms, with the expectation of achieving durable disease modification and potentially clonal eradication. A 74-year-old man with dyspnea, proximal muscle weakness, and hypoxemia. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Pierre Ancoma and colleagues. A 74-year-old man with myasthenia gravis developed worsening weakness, shortness of breath, and low oxygen levels while receiving prednisone and mycophenolate. In the weeks before admission, he also developed a painful tongue ulcer that had made eating difficult, persistent diarrhea, and increasing difficulty rising from a chair. During hospitalization, his blood counts declined and liver enzyme levels rose as his condition worsened despite treatment for presumed myasthenia exacerbation. Blood testing revealed a very high cytomegalovirus, CMV, viral load, and biopsy of the tongue ulcer confirmed disseminated CMV infection involving the oral mucosa, gastrointestinal tract, liver, and bone marrow. The patient improved initially with intravenous ganciclovir, immune globulin, and rehabilitation. However, after returning home, his weakness recurred, the tongue lesion enlarged, and he developed headache and blurred vision. Repeat biopsy and cerebrospinal fluid testing revealed disseminated Cryptococcus neoformans infection with meningitis. The patient received intensive antifungal therapy and management of elevated intracranial pressure, but the fungal burden remained high. Marijuana rescheduling, a game changer for research A perspective by Rebecca Haffagy from Yale School of Public Health, New Haven, Connecticut, and co-authors. On April 22nd, the U.S. Acting Attorney General issued a final rule immediately reclassifying state-licensed medical marijuana products and future Food and Drug Administration FDA-approved marijuana products under Schedule 3 of the Controlled Substances Act. Medical marijuana, defined as cannabis containing at least 0.3% tetrahydrocannabinol, now legal in 40 states, 3 territories, and the District of Columbia, was previously federally designated as a Schedule 1 drug, the category of drugs that are most tightly controlled. If the rule withstands legal challenge, will this rescheduling in fact increase much-needed research on medical marijuana? These authors believe that though it will have some benefit, it will not be the game changer that many people predict. Historically, 3 barriers have hindered marijuana research. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, limited the supply of marijuana products available for research. The DEA imposed restrictive and resource-intensive regulations on researchers who study the drug. And Congress and other agencies provided limited funding for research on marijuana as a therapeutic agent. Moving marijuana to Schedule 3 partially addresses the first 2 barriers, but it does not address the third. Lowering the regulatory barriers to research is a welcome step, but research cannot progress in the absence of funding. Crew Resource Management, Navigating AI's Automation Paradox, a perspective by Raja Eli Abdulnoor from Harvard Medical School, Boston, and co-authors. Viewed through a relational lens, artificial intelligence has entered the clinical space as a co-pilot, a computer system that informs decision-making by means of human-like interactions. AI co-pilots augment clinicians' skills in the service of patient care. Indeed, systems based on large language models now draft clinical notes, generate accurate differential diagnoses, and propose management plans with increasing fluency. But this partnership poses a risk. The more capable the AI co-pilot appears, the more likely clinicians are to offload tasks to it, eroding the very skills they need for detecting when it's wrong. The de-skilled clinician, and especially the never-skilled or mis-skilled learner, is left exposed to AI's fluency traps and silent failures. This automation paradox is a human hazard, compounding AI limitations such as confabulations, susceptibility to misinformation, and sycophancy. How can clinicians realize AI's promise while avoiding its perils? And how should educators prepare trainees to take control when the co-pilot fails? Aviation Crew Resource Management, CRM, offers a proven framework for navigating AI's jagged edge. Developed for high-stakes cockpit environments, CRM is a team training strategy designed to preserve coordination, vigilance, and performance. A crew resource management-informed approach promotes context-sensitive situational awareness, priming the clinician to foresee fluency traps hidden in AI outputs. When a trap is sensed, the clinician cross-checks an AI output before choosing to discard or trust its judgment. This verify-then-trust behavior promotes effective co-reasoning, calibrated reliance, knowing which AI to trust for what and when, and upskilling. The broader dangers of abandoning SGM health research. A perspective by Carl Streed, Jr. from the Boston University Chobanian and Avedisian School of Medicine. A 52-year-old transgender woman who has been taking estrogen for 20 years comes to Dr. Streed's primary care clinic. What is her estimated 10-year and 30-year cardiovascular risk? What about the 45-year-old cisgender woman who went through menopause in her 30s? Both of their cardiovascular risk profiles are ill-defined by standard calculators that weren't developed with these scenarios in mind. Multiply the proportion of such cases by thousands of daily clinical encounters, and the cost of recent terminations of federally supported research becomes clear. Physicians must make decisions without evidence that should exist and would exist if research were judged on scientific merit rather than political acceptability. In March 2025, Dr. Streed's federally funded research on sexual and gender minority, SGM Health, was terminated after nearly a decade of work. The justification? It was, quote, unscientific and did, quote, nothing to enhance the health of many Americans. One project was a longitudinal study assessing cardiovascular health in transgender adults. Among the first studies that were adequately powered to inform guidelines for clinicians facing the sorts of scenarios just described, teams at multiple institutions were investigating the biologic embedding of minority stress, how chronic adversity produces physiological changes with implications reaching far beyond SGM populations. These projects had survived National Institutes of Health study sections and program officer review. They were terminated not because they failed scientifically, but because they had become politically inconvenient. The ensuing damage is wide-ranging. Farewell to All This, a perspective by Deborah Molina, perspective editor for the journal. After more than two decades at the NEJM, Deborah Molina is retiring as the journal's perspective editor, the only person to have filled that role to date. According to NEJM lore, the perspective section was conceived as a treatment for the systemic condition that an editorial board member, since dubbed the godfather of the perspective section, had diagnosed. The journal has lost its soul. Although Debbie is neither a physician nor a spiritual healer, she likes to believe she has done her part to remedy that ailment. Over the past 23 years of soul searching, the small but mighty perspective team has cultivated a broad view of the contexts in which medicine and healthcare develop, live, function, and contribute, and the benefits to doctors, patients, and society of physicians understanding these contexts and factoring them into their work. Debbie's tenure at NEJM, though a blip in the journal's 214-year history, began when typescripts were edited in pencil and ends with the invasion of AI. Along the way, Debbie has learned a little about medicine and more about the Affordable Care Act, alternative payment models, FDA approval pathways, residents' duty hours, and physician burnout than she ever imagined wanting to know. But Debbie is convinced that no matter what happens, medicine will continue to influence and be influenced by myriad other sectors and aspects of human society. And physicians will, in her humble opinion, still be better doctors, citizens, and humans if they are well-informed and open-minded enough to explore those interfaces. They will simply, starting now, have to do it without her help. As Debbie now says, goodbye to our readers. In our images in clinical medicine, an 82-year-old man was brought to the emergency department after being found down. 1 week earlier, he had returned from a one-month visit to Chad, his country of birth, and had started having weakness. A peripheral blood smear showed ring-form trophozoites within erythrocytes. On the basis of the presence of several criteria, including impaired consciousness, acidosis, renal impairment, and a parasitemia level of greater than 10%, a diagnosis of severe P. falciparum malaria was made. In another image, a 73-year-old woman with rheumatoid arthritis and a 10-month history of pantoprazole therapy presented with skin lesions on her torso. Annular polycyclic lesions were observed on her upper back. A diagnosis of drug-induced subacute cutaneous lupus erythematosus was made. Culprit medications include thiazides, anti-tumor necrosis factor agents, and proton pump inhibitors, the last of which were considered to be the trigger in this case. In a third image, a woman presented with a 2-year history of pain, swelling, and stiffness in the wrists and fingers. Deformities were noted in her fingers and thumbs. When the hands were clenched into fists or pressed against the table, the joint deformities largely resolved, a finding consistent with Jacques's arthropathy. See the video at nejm.org. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.